argument is 22-2003, Torres v. DHS.
Good morning, Mr.
Sakai. Is it Sakai?
Yes.
Please proceed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Howard Sakai. On behalf of the petitioner, Crispin Torres, we ask this Court to vacate the arbitrator's decision and to remand for determination of a mitigated penalty for two related reasons. First, the penalty of removal here constitutes an abuse of discretion in that it is unreasonably harsher than that imposed on other law enforcement officers in the very same agency for the very same type of offense, and because the arbitrator categorically and unreasonably rejected Mr. Torres's potential for rehabilitation. With respect to the...
Can I just jump in? I mean, I am certainly very sympathetic to your client here. It seems like a first offense. It was certainly a mistake. You should not falsify your time records and ask for money from the government that you're not due. But we're operating under an abuse of discretion standard, which is really incredibly high for you. And as long as the arbitrator's decision explains itself and is within, as I understand the language of describing this, the reasonable bounds of all possibilities, then we can't do anything. So why is this not within the reasonable bound, particularly when the agency's own, the chart that says possible penalties for a first offense for this type of penalty includes removal?
Sure, Your Honor. And we understand that obviously it is within the range. And obviously the standard review here is, as you said, very much deferential and difficult. We believe this case is one of the few exceptions. The reason, the disparate treatment here.
Does it really turn on, I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but the time is short and I just want to get right to
sure.
it. I thought the arbitrator reasonably explained why some of the comparator evidence you brought wasn't relevant, but the one case you want to turn it on is the other agent that yeah. had the similar issue, a falsification issue, and was not removed. Now, the arbitrator said that's because the deciding official in that case didn't note any possible deep labor problems. I mean, that seems to be a reasonable distinction. It may be that the deciding official got it wrong, but what can we do about that?
Okay. Now, Your Honor, that is indeed the crux of the issue here, okay? Of course that HSI, Homeland Security Investigations investigator, of course he was Giglio impaired. By law, he was Giglio impaired. The fact that the agency did not even mention it in its decision is actually troubling and problematic in of itself, because it would be a violation of law for the agency to not turn that over to the prosecution, and worse, the prosecution not to turn that over, that type of evidence, falsification, misrepresentation. So whether they mention or not, whether they rely upon or not, he's Giglio impaired. And no more, and equally as Mr. Torres, and in fact, because of the nature of his position, in all likelihood, much greater Giglio impaired than Mr. Torres.
I get that, and it seems like the agency needs to be consistent if it's going to use this. But I also worry about requiring the agency to have a one-size-fits-all rule, because it seems to me, in some circumstances, even if they're Giglio impaired, the agency could still decide, well, that's not enough to fire them or the like, because we can still, make use of them. How do we know that's not what happened in that comparator case?
Because, Your Honor, there is the record, respectfully, is devoid of any of that additional evidence that would turn their conclusion that he's Giglio impaired and therefore lacking rehabilitative potential to turn that into anything other than conclusory. Because if you take that away, there is nothing there, respectfully.
Is there any evidence about how often Mr. Torres had to, during his time at DHS, offer testimony?
So this came up late in the briefing, so there was not an opportunity for it to be developed on the record. So the court can take judicial notice of the distinction between ERO, enforcement removal operations, where deportation officers are situated, as opposed to Homeland Security Investigations, SSI, which are the detectives of ICE. I could submit on good faith, it's not in the record, that Mr. Torres has testified only once in his career when he was in training and was getting exposure to a case that he normally does not work on. I could say also in good faith that it is rare for deportation officers to testify. His workplace performance appraisals indicate very little work on prosecutions, and this is in stark contrast to what HSI does. They are the detectives of the agency. They're the ones swearing out warrants, affidavits, and testifying in court because they're making cases. And, you know, the fact that the agency didn't...
It seems like so much of the deciding official's rationale in this case was the potential for a Giglio impairment for the law students. What that means is whenever you have a law enforcement officer and they're found guilty of something that amounts to misrepresentation or fraud, there's a concern about their later ability to offer truthful testimony in court. Will they be able to effectively give testimony, or, you know, using them as the relevant law enforcement officer when they have this in their background, does it automatically make them someone who cannot be trusted and therefore will undermine the agency and not be able to perform their job? So given that the deciding official put so much emphasis on the Giglio rationale, is there any obligation on the part of the agency to discuss or identify the type of job in which the person is in and the likelihood that their job would actually require them to give testimony? Because there are some law enforcement officers that never give testimony, and there are others that testify all the time. So given that this deciding official put so much of an emphasis on that one thing to the exclusion of his otherwise perfect employment history, what obligation, if any, does the law require of the agency to offer proof in that nature?
Your Honor, that's an excellent point. I think that in order to do the Douglas factors due justice and observing the totality of the circumstances, there cannot be just a categorical rejection of a type of job or a type of conduct that is the telltale of what the end result should be. And that is clear from this court's case law. I do think that the arbitrator did find that this was a significant, he said, critical aggravating factor. And when you look through the briefing and you look at his decision, it's clear that he erroneously, incorrectly, assumed that was not, had nothing to do with that HSI investigator. Had he realized that, okay, and had he saw that this critical aggravating factor was actually a factor, whether anyone wants to admit it or not, in that other case, then we realize that this case is on all fours. If that individual, who's likely testifying much more than Mr. Torres or any other deportation officer, if he can be rehabilitated, then why can't Mr. Torres? So it's not that that automatically means it goes one way or the other.
Is rehabilitation a forward-going process? Is evaluation, when they look here at Mr. Torres and say, for these reasons, this individual can be rehabilitated? Or is rehabilitated determined by the history of the employee, and in this case, exemplary reviews that he had and things of that nature? Or is it both?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of your question. Is there a path forward for...
Right. When we're talking about rehabilitation, are we talking about future training, sending the employee for training, and things of that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that all is relevant and can be relevant. I think we obviously look at the nature of the conduct. It was serious. It was undeniably wrong, and you recognize that. That recognition should be taken into account. This was clearly aberrant, okay? It was undeniably...
Just to be clear, he recognized it after he got caught. You know, like, I mean, it's not like he came forward and said, okay, look, I got to admit something. I did this thing wrong. His hand was in a cookie jar, and then he recognized his hand was in a cookie jar.
Understood, Your Honor. But nonetheless, he is here, profoundly remorseful, and understands that this will never happen again. It cannot happen again. And it clearly, this is an aberrant exercise. If you look at his unblemished 11-year career, like that HSI investigator who had 8 years.
Can I ask you a hypothetical? Suppose that instead of his position, he had an investigator position, and that the record showed that he testified on an almost monthly basis. Would that make this case different, even if another investigator had not been removed for a first offense?
It's an excellent question, Your Honor. I think it would make the case harder. Certainly, they would have an additional reason.
And that assumes the deciding official went through this and said, even though this is the first offense, he is a person that regularly testifies before us on a monthly basis, and we're going to have to disclose this in every single case, and he's going to get cross-examined. I think that in that instance, you might have a really tough uphill battle on abuse of discretion, even if you have a comparator that wasn't suffered from the same effects.
Your Honor, I agree. I think in that case, that would be much more difficult. Could still make the argument you would have, in fact, you would have an inconsistency between the rehabilitative potential analysis conflicting with a clear disparate penalty.
But I guess my problem in that hypothetical relying on the comparator is, you know, that decision maybe didn't do a good job of explaining why there was rehabilitation aspects or not, but I don't know that we can fault the agency retrospectively for not explaining it. Maybe they were going to reassign that person to some other position or the like. If it's not in the record, we don't know that. What we know is what's in this record. But in this record, at least as far as I understand, and, you know, I'm not going to, you know, consider your representations about his testifying because it's not in the record, but you can just look at his job duties and see that it's not likely in his record, I don't think. We'll see if the government disputes that. But the unexplained nature of the DiGuglio impairment in the deciding official seems troubling here, where it wouldn't if they gave a more fulsome analysis of what impact it would have had.
Understood, Your Honor. And I think the distinction here, to answer that point directly, is that the sole basis for finding that he had no rehabilitative potential was because of the Giglio impairment. But if we follow that line of reasoning, then you're just leading down clear imposition of disparate and arbitrary penalties.
Either that or every law enforcement agency in the federal government that disciplines somebody for anything related to falsification or dishonesty has to fire them.
Well, there shouldn't be. We're not arguing that there's a clear line one way or the other. But we cited cases.
It's a friendly question. Just say yes.
With that, I'll reserve the remainder of my vote for thought.
May it please the court. This is a classic case of the agency's broad discretion
to decide. I know you're stuck with the facts. You don't work at DHS, you work at the Justice Department, you're here to do your best. But this case has all the hallmarks of them using this as an excuse to get rid of an employee they don't think is a highly performing employee. I've been around these cases long enough to look at his performance evaluation record and see he is not, in the agency's view, a high-performing employee. And when the deciding official gives no explanation of how this Giglio impairment is going to impact his continued job performance, that is really suspect. I mean, aren't they at least required to explain for somebody that doesn't work as an investigator, that works as somebody that takes people back and forth on airplanes, how Giglio impacts their job duties?
Your Honor, based on the record, it's clear that the job responsibility of a deportation officer, based on his performance work plans, that he is subject to investigating potential.
I understand it's in the job duties and the performance work plan, but is it actually in his duties? And if it was, why didn't the deciding official explain that more fully? I mean, I think if the deciding official had said, this person testifies on a regular basis, then you wouldn't have a problem. Now, of course, if that's not true, then, let's just assume, even though his performance work plan and his job duties in his official appointment say testifying and investigating and testifying, let's just assume that he has never done that. The counsel represented him once, but for the hypothetical, let's just assume in his entire, how many years did he work at this agency?
For approximately 11 years.
In 11 years, he has never once been called to testify to court. Then how does Giglio impact his continued performance?
It's the possibility that he can be called. And he is expected as part of his critical job responsibilities.
The problem I have with that is that results in a conclusion which is not the policy of DHS as I understand it. But what you just articulated would suggest that every law enforcement officer, if there exists even the slightest possibility that they could be called to testify, must be fired for any conduct that suggests misrepresentation or fraud or any sort of question of credibility. And that's not, the range of penalties aren't written that way, the DHS policy is not written that way, but that was the answer you just gave to Judge Hughes. The answer you just gave to Judge Hughes affords no discretion within the agency.
It does afford broad discretion, and it's a range of punishment based on a table of penalties.
If you're going to exercise that discretion, then you have to explain that exercise of discretion. Your answer to me was the agency gets to determine without any reasoned explanation that if there's a falsification offense, that they might be Giglio impaired, and it's within your sole discretion to remove them or not. That may be true, but it has to be reasoned discretion. Otherwise, if you're just saying, what I think you're saying is, they're all subject to removal, you can't apply that arbitrarily. And clearly, it is not going to be the policy of the United States government that everybody that commits a falsification offense has to be fired.
That's correct, but here, it was not just a falsification offense. It was a falsification of certified records that not only happened multiple times.
I know, we're not talking about the severity of the penalty, or the severity of the conduct here. It's bad. He should not have done this. But now we're talking about the rehabilitation prong of Douglas. And so all you have on that is possible Giglio impairment for a person that doesn't look like they're ever going to testify very much.
That's not the case, Your Honor. The record states, for example, at Appendix 160, one of his critical responsibilities is prosecution. And in that role, he has to be prepared to identify or present cases for civil or criminal proceedings.
You can't rely on his theoretical job duties, because I bet a lot of these people that never testify have that in their job duties as well. And so that just allows the agency to say no rehabilitation, even if there's zero possibility. Let me ask you, this is not a critical too. Same facts here, same job duties, everything, but there, because of what the office he works for, there is zero possibility that in this job he will ever testify. Is Giglio a basis for removal and no rehabilitation finding if there is zero chance of testifying, even if it's in his job duties?
Your Honor, it's not just about Giglio.
You need to answer that question.
I think
that's a yes or no question. If he has zero chance of ever testifying, despite what his actual job duties sheet says, is Giglio a basis for removal?
I think the assumption of the zero possibility is itself unlikely, and that's
No. Okay, I'm not trying to trap you. I'm just trying to ask a hypothetical, and you're not giving anything away if you answer the hypothetical candidly. And you know what the answer is. I know you know what the answer is. So just tell me what you think the answer is. If there is zero chance that this person will ever be called to testify, it's an absolute impossibility, his actual job duties, despite his position description, which may be overbroad, containing it. Giglio can't be a basis for firing somebody if they're never going to testify, right? Because that's the
yes, that's correct, and that was not the only basis here.
But no, okay, but you, that was my hypothetical.
If that was the
only, if that's the only basis here, then Giglio was not a sufficient basis to show a lack of rehabilitation.
It depends on managerial discretion, Your Honor.
Well, where is the managerial discretion explained here? That's my real problem in this case, is the signing official didn't sufficiently tie up his actual job duties with Giglio. Can you point me to anything in the record that specifically talked about, I am aware of what this person does, and, you know, he has, you know, or will be required to testify in the future?
Not related to his role in terms of testifying in court and potentially being impeached under Giglio, but there is, at Appendix 1109, when he testified before the arbitrator, where he said that he lost confidence himself in Mr. Torres, because there are often times when deportation officers are called upon to work independently without supervision. And he lost the ability for Mr. Torres to tell the truth and be honest.
So I get that, but is that what the arbitrator relied on? I thought the basis for the arbitrator finding no rehabilitation was purely Giglio and not the deciding official's lack of confidence.
It was not only that, it was his role as a law enforcement officer that they're held to a higher standard of conduct. The fact that he cannot trust his ability to tell the truth because he affirmed, he certified 3 times in an attempt to cover up his lies, when as a deportation officer working in that role for the government for over 11 years, he knew better. But instead, at every opportunity to tell the truth, he decided to not tell the truth and to conceal it. And overall, that gravity of the offense is distinguishable from the criminal investigator case, because a verbal statement that's incorrect, a misstatement or false statement, is different than when you, as an officer before a court or before the government, when you're asserting something is accurate and the truth, and you're affirming that in writing multiple times to get more money or to, in terms of his time in attendance or his overtime or in compliance with his deportation duties. In all those instances, he made false statements in writing and he certified to that effect.
I get all that, but doesn't that all go to severity of the offense and we're talking about rehabilitation?
It does, Your Honor. And to the extent that you are reweighing the evidence here, that is not this court's role to do.
I'm not reweighing the evidence. I'm saying that the arbitrator's finding of rehabilitation is either arbitrary or capricious or not supported by substantial evidence or an abuse of discretion, whichever one you want to standard, whichever way you characterize it. Because he relied to me, as I read it, solely on Giglio. And if that's wrong, then he has to reconsider. I'm not suggesting that this is not a severe offense and it warrants a penalty, maybe a significant one. But if the arbitrator improperly considered one of the Douglas factors, doesn't it have to come back?
Your Honor, the way to give the relevant Douglas factors to include the rehabilitative potential of Mr. Torres or the consistency of the punishment given across the agency for same or similar offenses, that primarily lies within the agency's broad discretion. And even if this was remanded...
It lies within their discretion, but they can't act arbitrarily, correct?
That is correct. But
so I think the concern here that was expressed by Mr. Torres's attorney is there exists at least one other case in the same agency which had similar type of conduct and which resulted in only a 14-day suspension, despite the fact that that law enforcement officer is of a type more likely to offer testimony than Mr. Torres. So how is that not a comparator case and potentially relevant so that we ensure the agency is not acting arbitrarily?
Your Honor, because all of that with the comparator case is speculation. The record is light in terms of what his supervisor or what in that particular instance considered. There is no reference.
The record's pretty light on whether Mr. Torres is going to testify also.
The record for that specific factor is light, but it's harmless error. So there's no indication that even if this case were to be remanded, that the decision of the deciding official or the arbitrator would be any different, because the substantial evidence in this particular case, and not the case that Mr. Torres would like this court to consider to reweigh, in essence, how those Douglas factors should be considered. The evidence in this case supports that his direct first-line supervisor and those above him, that the agency in this instance lost trust and confidence in his ability to do...
I'd like to ask you a question in that regard. And you led right into the area I wanted to discuss. The deciding official's use of trust and his confidence in whether Mr. Torres would be able to continue or not, be rehabilitated. I see that line in this case and in other similar type of cases, and I'm always left wondering, what girds, what support does the deciding official have in making that type of evaluation to say, without any evidence, without any expert testimony or anything, to say that Mr. Torres cannot be rehabilitated because I have lost trust in him. I believe this to me is an area where we approach an unreasonable decision by the deciding officer.
Your Honor, the record indicates that the deciding officer did consider Douglas Factor 6. The record also indicates that the agency looked across nationwide for similar offenses regarding falsification or lack of candor.
At what point does the personal, emotional level of trust of the deciding official come into play?
It's not about personal.
How are we supposed to review that? How can I review the deciding official's level of trust? There's nothing in the record that permits me to do that.
There is substance in the record in terms of the testimony of the direct line supervisor of Mr. Torres, along with the deciding official, and no single factor is outcome determinative.
But so one of the things that you've argued to us today is that, okay, there's potential for Giglio impairment, but there's also, Mr. Ortega, is that the correct deciding official's name, Mr. Ortega?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Mr. Ortega's testimony included that he had lost trust in Mr. Torres, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
What do we do with the fact that during his testimony on page 1117, in particular page 148 of that manuscript deposition or testimony, what do we do with the fact that the reason he gave for having lost faith in Mr. Torres, the reason he gave for being suspicious that Mr. Torres would do this again, is because he said he remembered that another officer said he didn't in fact come home early to see his family. He came home early for a different reason. And then, as I understand it in this record, that was investigated and proved to be completely untrue, that the other person who the deciding official thought was offering testimony that Mr. Torres had an ulterior motive said that is completely false. So what do we do with that? To the extent that the deciding official said, I don't trust the guy, I agree with you, he said that. But the reason, the only reason he gave for not trusting him was that he thought Mr. Torres had an ulterior motive and he thought someone had represented that he had an ulterior motive for actually coming home. Because that would be different, right? Like, there, for sure, if not only did the guy falsify his documents, but on top of that, he was lying during the investigation about what happened. I mean, Mr. Torres was completely honest in this investigation. That's what was found, you know, by the officials. What do we make of the fact that Mr. Ortega's testimony seems to hinge in some part on this belief that turns out to be inaccurate, that there was evidence that Mr. Torres had this ulterior motive?
Your Honor, I have exceeded my time. May I answer your question?
Yes, I would very much like that.
The record reflects that the deciding official considered Mr. Torres's basis for coming home early, and he disagreed that that was a justifiable basis. Mr. Torres repeatedly indicated it was just to be with his family.
You're not answering my question. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about, where Mr. Ortega, on page 149, are you familiar with this?
Yes.
Mr. Ortega claims that another DHS employee, that he believes another DHS employee, gave evidence that suggested that Mr. Torres did not come home early to see his family, the way he explained. And that turns out to be completely false. So what do we do with that? Because if Mr. Ortega thinks not only did the guy falsify stuff, but during the investigation he's lying about all of it, you know, you could kind of understand why he would have even less confidence. But it turns out that at least this rationale turns out to be completely untrue.
Based on the chief's question and what I was asking you before, shouldn't we look at this situation as a reason why we should not trust the reasonableness of the decision of the deciding official?
The reasonableness of the deciding official didn't just stem on the reason Mr. Torres provided for lying officially in certified records. It could have easily been resolved whether it was to be with his family or for some other reason that does not justify his offense. And to the extent that this court disagrees.
But it's not about justifying his offense. Nobody said that. What I said to you is Mr. Ortega, the deciding official, seems to have based part of his rationale on why Mr. Torres is not trustworthy and therefore not capable of rehabilitation on something that turned out to be completely wrong. There was no proof in this record anywhere that there was an ulterior motive for Mr. Torres. Yet Ortega thought that, and even told in his testimony, well, I think there's an affidavit in here that says this, and there wasn't. So how is, you know, to the extent that we're talking about rehabilitation, we've got a deciding official that thinks Mr. Torres has lied during the investigation, gave testimony to that effect, and it turns out he's wrong. Didn't happen. What do we do with that? Doesn't that affect his analysis, potentially, about whether Mr. Torres is capable of rehabilitation?
Your Honor, if there was any kind of error of that extent in what the deciding official considered or misunderstood in terms of what he believed the record supported, what evidence there was to exist the basis of Mr. Torres's return, that would just be harmless his testimony of considering.
Let me ask you this as a hypothetical. So we're still talking about rehabilitation, and let's just assume there's two bases for the deciding official's conclusion that there's no rehabilitation petition. One is Giglio. Let's assume that's off the boards because we think that there's no evidence to show that he's actually going to have to testify. So you're left with your backup position, which was the deciding official said he lost trust in him. Let's assume that the deciding official's explanation for why he lost trust is just wrong. It's factually wrong. He didn't apprehend the true facts. How can we rely on that lost trust if it's based upon a factual mistake? And this is hypothetical, so don't tell me other things that support it. If those two things are wrong, one's based upon an arbitrary application of Giglio, one based on a factual misapprehension, you have no basis for the rehabilitation finding, right?
Well, the way that the deciding officer considered Douglas factor number one, the seriousness of the offense.
No, we're talking about rehabilitation. And please, you know better than this. You have to answer the hypotheticals. Don't give the law student a misimpression that it's okay to do this. I don't want to talk about the severity of offense. You win on the severity of offense. All we're talking about is rehabilitation. And so the two proper arguments for no rehabilitation are just wrong. We have to send it back again, right? I know you don't agree with the hypothetical, but if that's the case, you have to agree that it goes back.
Your Honor, the government respectfully disagrees that...
No, you have to explain to me why you disagree then. I mean, you can't make that assertion. You know, your office knows better. If I'm asking you a hypothetical which says there's only two bases for the no rehabilitation finding. They're both incorrect. There's no other basis. Then we have to send it back on rehabilitation, don't we?
If it's limited to those specific factors, yes, Your Honor. But here we have a balancing test. There's no bright line rules. There's multiple factors for the agency and its broad discretion to consider. And the removal penalty here was substantially supported within their broad discretion. And the government respectfully requests that this court not reweigh that evidence and affirm the decision below.
Thank you, Ms. Finn. Mr. Sakai, you have a little time.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'll be brief. Two quick points on rebuttal. First, just to respond to what my opposing colleague has mentioned. For purpose of Giglio, there is no difference between whether it was a written falsification or a verbal misrepresentation. With respect to the loss of trust, respectfully, that exists for every single law enforcement officer who, or any employee for that matter, who has been charged with sustained charges of an act of dishonesty, as we have here. The question really comes down to the Douglas factor. Can that officer, can that employee be rehabilitated from that loss of trust? And the record here is wholly absent of that. And in addition, if Mr. Ortega, the deciding official, had as one of the bases for that loss of trust something that turns out to be not true, then indeed, to Your Honor's questions, that would be grounds for the findings not being supported by substantial evidence.
So what is the relief that you are seeking from us?
So obviously this court has the power to, it generally does not impose its own penalties. It generally vacates and remands below for a penalty. In this case, we are asking for mitigation, and then it would be up to the decision maker, in this case, the arbitrator, to determine the appropriate penalty that is something less harsh than removal.
I like that answer. Thank you for not standing up and telling me that I should decide a new penalty, because that wouldn't be proper. And, you know, I'm sure that, you know, you were maybe a little bit tempted to say that, and it wouldn't be proper. The most we can give you is a vacated remand.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. I thank both counsel for these cases taken.
Thank you, Your Honors.